In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Anyone involved in the liberty movement, especially in places like Deep Blue, Oregon, it can often feel like you keep fighting and fighting and nothing ever gets done. Nothing changes. One of the things we have been fighting here on iSpy is the modern day environmental movement, in particular, their war on carbon dioxide. While that's been dragging on even before we started in 2011, right now, it turns out we are standing right at the very edge of finally seeing a genuine victory on that. Because it's been rumored that Trump is about to throw out the endangerment ruling that Obama's EPA shoved through, and if that happens, that will be yanking out the linchpin of the far-left environmental movement that sees mankind as the problem, and even worse, has been a massive funding model for far-left ideology. We're talking trillions of taxpayer dollars over the years. But that might just be all coming crumbling down. And then, of course, there will be the typical court battles, but even that looks hopeful right now. Way back in the day, I gave a small speech to the Executive Club up in Portland, which is a group of conservatives who routinely meet, I think once a month, and hear speakers on various topics. You know the drill. Anyway, my presentation was we were looking for some funding to do an investigation into the Energy Trust of Oregon that we were put onto just a few weeks after being on air. It was an industry insider who tipped us off to what was really happening behind the scenes. Because the Energy Trust of Oregon, best known for giving away energy efficiency rebates, a massive amount of their money was going to things like administrative costs and going to very far-left organizations, some of which were the type that wanted to pull out high-efficiency hydroelectric dams on the Columbia and replace them with low-efficiency and more expensive green energy. A good chunk of that money was also going to, I forget the exact term, but it was something like program management or implementation, which effectively meant marketing far-left ideas. So think about that. They were taking money that everybody who was paying utility bills was mandated to pay. 6% of your monthly bill went to this public purpose surcharge, which provided the funding for the Energy Trust of Oregon. The primary purpose of those funds were those energy rebates. But instead, good chunks of that money was going to far-left marketing and organizing, effectively training the troops so that way when an election rolled around, Democrats had talking points and issues to run on. And they had boots on the ground and experienced marketers all ready to go, courtesy of the Oregon taxpayers and ratepayers. I was speaking to that executive club because we were looking to raise funds to expose and pull apart the Energy Trust, and to do that, we needed to hire forensic accountants and other investigators. But we could never get anywhere. Maybe it was because Republicans at the legislature weren't very interested to let go of that Energy Trust cash cow. The Energy Trust was supposed to sunset, but at least two Republicans that I know of swooped in to save it, and you are still paying the far left every time you pay your utility bill for your home or business. When it comes to investigating these kinds of things, we are definitely not alone in hitting brick walls. It doesn't help that the government shields itself, hiding communication as they scheme, plot to spend someone else's money, your money. Now, if you're a business owner, you have a right to see the emails your employees are sending out on behalf of conducting business for your business. Allegedly, government employees work for the public. Us. But good luck trying to get those emails or other information. It's almost like they don't want the public to see what they're actually talking about. Kimberly Herman is the executive director for Southeastern Legal Foundation, an organization that fights to protect your rights against government overreach. And among other things, they have been battling to get information and emails from the government, well, pretty much forever. Kim, it is good to talk to you today.
Great to be with you, Mark.
So doing the prep for the show, I looked back at our very first show with your predecessor at Southeastern Legal, way back in week 41 of our very first year, we were discussing the Clean Air Act and the endangerment finding then. And part of that discussion was accusations that the EPA had used preordained science to come up with the endangerment finding. Here we are nearly 15 years later, and the endangerment finding could be finally at an end. But one of the reasons why we wanted to have you on today is the Competitive Enterprise Institute, through a FOIA request, finally uncovered some emails from Obama's EPA and did find the evidence we had talked about way back on that first show. The EPA did use predetermined science that became the basis for that endangerment finding. The Clean Air Act and that endangerment finding gave the EPA the power to regulate greenhouse gases, especially carbon dioxide. Now, this is something you guys have been fighting for literally as long as we have known you. Can you talk to us about the endangerment finding and the Clean Air Act and the impact they have on business and industry?
Yeah, I mean, this goes back to one of the very, very first things that I worked on at Southeastern Legal Foundation in 2008. So, right, we're going back some time here. But, you know, under the Obama administration, we got what was called the endangerment finding. Mm-hmm. And basically, this was a bunch of hocus-pocus kind of junk science that the federal government, the EPA, came out with to justify an unbelievable, egregious power grab over America, mm-hmm. right? And it was to take over all of our energy and to get rid of, you know, drill, baby, drill, right? We all have to kind of remember this is back in those days when they were vehemently opposed to drill, baby, drill. And so they came out with this endangerment finding, and from that, the EPA got to work promulgating and putting in place regulation after regulation after regulation that shut down entire industries in this country, raised the prices of energy, and had no basis in science and no basis in the Constitution.
Trump is expected to throw that out pretty much any day now. I know that he had directed Lee Zeldin, he heads the EPA, to look into getting rid of that. And allegedly, about a month later, Lee has come back with, yeah, that needs to go. Are you hearing anything directly in terms of when that is likely to be thrown out?
You know, this administration is moving just as fast as possible, and the Supreme Court is on the side of throwing this out here, right? Mm. All of that work, all of the FOIA work we did back in 2007, 2008, 2009, led to a Supreme Court victory in 2014, mm-hmm. where Justice Scalia famously said that he would not stand on the edge of the dock and watch as the EPA sailed away and basically got to do whatever in the world they wanted to do. It was a massive rein in of administrative power with our fourth branch of government, the administrative state. And so the law and the Constitution is on the side of the Trump administration now. And so just like everything else, I expect them to act very, very quickly.
Well, I certainly hope so. And again, this has such huge implications because it really, it effectively ushered in the whole green movement. All of the solar panels, all of the windmills and everything else that became mandated. What would be the impact of this? And I mean, let's actually back up a little bit. In terms of the endangerment finding, it was mainly focused on carbon dioxide. I know it looked at some other greenhouse gases as well, but that carbon dioxide, that's the one that is so critical. Would that have a rollover effect into states as well, I mean, if that's thrown out? Because right now, Oregon is doing some carbon credits and some of the other nonsense, all based on this false science that carbon dioxide is a danger. So would throwing out the endangerment finding, would that endanger some of these state policies?
Yes, and it absolutely should, right? That's a great question. And when you look at each state, you know, version of the EPA, if you will, everything that they have done since 2009, again, like you said, has been based on this endangerment finding. Whether we are talking about environmental justice, where they're trying to bring in these ideas of equity instead of equality through regulation and state requirements, whether they are actually shutting down full industries, and like you said, pushing solar, pushing some of these alternative energy sources that cost a significant amount of money and don't actually help the environment when you dig into it. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, this is absolutely going to trickle down as it should.
You're absolutely right. They don't actually help the environment. There's been several studies that have pointed out that in terms of mining and refining the rare earth minerals that so much of the green energy depends on, for every one ton that is refined, it generates up to 2,000 tons of toxic waste. So there's your green movement. All right, it's time for a break. Everyone stay with us. We'll continue talking about this endangerment finding and what it will mean if it goes away. We're doing that with Kim Herman of Southeastern Legal Foundation. Their website is slfliberty.org. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today to Kim Herman. She is the Executive Director of Southeastern Legal Foundation, and their website, again, is slfliberty.org. And you're saying during the break you guys are going to have a relaunch of your website. So tell us about that.
We are. A lot of the work that we do, in addition to litigation, is to empower Americans to understand their constitutional rights. And so we are launching a new website on Monday, or a refresh of our website, I should say, that will have guidebooks on all different constitutional topics, especially parental rights. So we hope everyone takes a visit to that and checks it out.
Oh, that'll be cool. I definitely look forward to that. And, you know, that first segment there, we were talking about this endangerment finding that essentially found CO2 as a greenhouse gas. If that goes away, I mean, gosh, you guys have been fighting that for years. What's that going to be like to not have that hanging over your head anymore?
Well, we have plenty of other battles that we're fighting, right, on the Title IX front, parental rights. And you know, another thing that we saw come out of the EPA recently is an announcement that they're going to be getting back to work to redefine waters of the United States so that the EPA does not come in and over-assert itself, if you will, saying that it has jurisdiction over your property just because there's a puddle on it.
Right.
The Trump administration is dedicated to bringing in a constitutional and proper definition of what a water of the United States is.
Oh, well, that would be awesome. So with the possibility that this endangerment finding gets thrown out, a rewrite of the Clean Waters or the Waters of the United States and some of these others, I imagine they're all going to be challenged in court. We've seen that with all of these federal judges. Anything that Trump does, they have inserted themselves into, and it's gotten pretty shocking, and that's going to be the focus of the second half of the show here. I assume that there's probably already legal planning to try to stop all of this.
There's no doubt, right? We've already seen, I mean, before President Trump even was inaugurated, you know, we saw Governor Newsom out in California hold a special session just to, you know, was it $22 million that he wanted, appropriated to be able to start to sue the administration. And so the blue states are going to sue, the environmental groups are going to sue. But that's also where groups like ours come in, right? We can stand there on the side of the administration and stand on the side of the Constitution and our laws to help defend these actions once we see what they are. Right. New rules will have to be proposed. Public comment will happen and then litigation will ensue. And if we've seen anything from the U.S. Supreme Court on these issues over the last 10 years, I'm confident that they will continue to rein in this administrative state and make sure that what comes out of the Trump administration can stand, because I'm sure it will be constitutional.
Well, we've talked in the past that it's always better to have Congress involved rather than simple executive orders. But in terms of getting rid of the endangerment finding, was that solely on the EPA side or was there some legislation behind that as well?
Yeah, I mean, so all of this is kind of being done under the Clean Air Act, right? And so you have Congress passes laws. They can then allow agencies to issue interpretations of these laws, right, where there's maybe ambiguities. This past year, we saw the Supreme Court come down and say that courts aren't going to defer to the agencies. They're going to look at what Congress said and look at the actual text of the law like it should. And so, you know, we have these laws from Congress. We have regulations from the agencies. They do work hand in hand, you know, but at the end of the day, I believe that what we're going to see is the court, like I said, and I mean, I've said it a million times and I'll say it a million more times. People are probably sick of me saying it out there. The court is sick of the administrative state running wild. Mm. And so if Congress wants to do this, they can come back and do it, but not the agency.
Mm. Well, in terms of these emails that were uncovered, they were essentially, they weren't quite falsifying the science, but it was pretty clear that they had already determined what that was going to be. And it kind of reminded me, you know, reading that Just the News article there about what Competitive Enterprise Institute had uncovered. It reminded me a lot of what happened down in the Klamath Basin when they were originally trying to take those dams out way back in 2011, 2012, somewhere in there. And what really tipped that over for us was there was a whistleblower. He was in charge of the science. And he was telling the agency, the science does not support what you're saying the science says. That these salmon were endangered and all of the rest. And that was, of course, the impetus for pulling out the dams. Oh, we got to save the salmon. So what the CEI uncovered sounded very much that same thing, where they have this predetermined, this is what we want the science to say. How does that impact when you've got, when you're arguing that case before, you know, with the Supreme Court or any other court? If their science doesn't support what they say it does, doesn't that effectively undermine everything? And why didn't that ever come forward?
Yeah, it absolutely does. And CEI has done a tremendous job over the last, you know, 15 plus years in exposing a lot of this corruption at the EPA. And, you know, it did come forward. When we were at the lower courts in this case, you know, in these cases, science was kind of at the forefront. And it was a lot of expert versus expert. What's actually the science? What should they have done? What's real? But the bigger issue when we got to the Supreme Court was kind of what we had been arguing the entire time, was that the EPA didn't have the authority to do what it was doing in the first place. Hmm. And so you can get in the weeds of the science, and we see this all the time. We see it with NOAA right now. We're challenging an egregious speed limit on boats that makes it so boats can't go any faster than a golf cart in the Atlantic Ocean right now, under the name of saving the whales. Nobody wants to save the whales more than voters. They love the outdoors. They love the animals. And they're overstepping here. And so we can argue about the science all day long, but they don't have the constitutional authority to do what they're doing in the first place.
Hmm. Well, and that's kind of a key issue when it comes to government, that if you don't have the authority, you shouldn't be doing it. All right, let's go take a break there. Coming back, we'll be talking about getting those emails and also some of these judges and the rulings that they've had against the Trump administration. We'll do that with Kim Herman. She is the executive director of the Southeastern Legal Foundation. And welcome back. We're talking today to Kim Herman. She is the executive director for Southeastern Legal Foundation. And you can find out more about them by heading to slfliberty.org. We'll link that up on today's show page, which is 15-12 on iSpyRadio.com. They've got a reboot of their website and lots more to look at there and learn more about your rights, which is what they do, is they protect your rights whenever the government is trying to trample all over them freely. Thankfully, here in the Trump administration, that is looking less and less frequent. So getting back to the emails that Competitive Enterprise managed to pry out of the government, you know, it just seems like getting emails from public officials who are conducting allegedly public work on behalf of the public for the good of the public is all too often hidden from the public. And I mean, this has been going on for years. You guys have certainly been fighting to get it famously there with the Biden emails. It doesn't seem like it should be this hard when they're conducting business on behalf of the public. But with all the FOIA court battles Southeastern Legal has waged, I mean, have you guys ever come up with some suggestions to make this easier and faster? It just seems like if you're working for the public in unclassified roles where there isn't national security concerns, this should be a lot easier.
I mean, it should be a lot easier, right? And so, you know, as American public, we have a right to see government records. And in a lot of states, they actually have to respond to open records requests in like 3 to 5 days. So it's a really, really short turnaround time period. Unfortunately, our federal FOIA doesn't have the same type of time limits on it. And that's not to say that our state governments don't violate those on a regular basis. But, you know, really to see some amendments to FOIA that would put some real deadlines on the government agencies. If they miss these deadlines, there are no consequences for them,
yeah.
Right? And so we're all forced to spend a tremendous amount of resources to sue just to get records that we all have a right to see.
Well, that has been the bugaboo pretty much from week one of iSpy Radio, is that it's so hard to hold public officials accountable. I mean, they can blow through $1 billion. Nobody seems to bat an eye at that. Nobody's held responsible. In fact, in a lot of ways, it's a means for promotion. Hey, I spent a $1 billion budget. Okay, great. So now let's see what you can do with $10 billion. I mean, holding government officials, again, it shouldn't be this difficult, but in terms of making that faster, is there any specific solutions that you guys have?
Really, I mean, you need the Congress to get involved here, right? And to amend the FOIA statute, because all of this is done statutorily. But, you know, we see the pushback. we see, you know, Doge and the Trump administration doing everything it can to expose all of the waste
yes.
that is happening in D.C., right? They're finally giving us all of these documents out there. And when I say us, I'm talking the American public, right? They're telling us, what are these line items in the budget? What is the money being spent on? And then you have, you know, half of the country saying, whoa, why are they telling us about this corruption? It's like things are completely backwards and bizarre. But this administration seems to be dedicated to transparency. And we're seeing that in our lawsuits, too. We're finally getting documents that we've been fighting for years and years and years from this administration.
Well, that's really cool that that's happening. You know, the Washington Post has its famous catchphrase there, that democracy dies in darkness. Well, democracy spends an awful lot of money in darkness as well. There was an executive order recently here that a judge has jumped in on, and the order was to stop USAID from continuing to fund these crazy far-left programs all across the world, and some people had sued, and they said that there was $2 billion yet that they were owed, and the judge effectively won, not won that case, but went ahead and did order that. But then the judge concluded that the court must be careful that any relief that it grants does not intrude on the prerogative of the executive branch. And so it was kind of confusing how that all came out. How do you see the role of these judges in terms of interfering with executive orders?
I mean, what we've seen to this point has been largely egregious from the courts. And the reason why is because what the people suing, what the left that is suing the Trump administration is seeking are temporary restraining orders. This is extraordinary relief, right? Temporary restraining orders are only meant when there is going to be an immediate harm that is just so unbelievable that the court has to step in. It's one thing to say, hey, we're going to pause everything and we're going to evaluate it as a court. It's another to order $2 billion of, you know, to be sent to USAID without properly evaluating the case. And so I think that there has to be a big examination about whether the courts here are overreaching. And the Supreme Court, at least Justice Alito in a dissent, you know, really kind of took the court to town on that, saying that they really did, you know, exceed their powers here.
Well, I think anybody looking at this from the outside would agree that, you know, these guys are exceeding their authority because, you know, the Babylon Bee actually had a pretty good meme the other day where a federal judge appointed himself president. And it's kind of like, you know, there's a lot of truth to that right now because they are clearly stepping on the executive powers. They are making decisions about troops. I mean, any number of things where these judges are inserting themselves. And is that going to come back to Congress reining in the court system? Because if I understand correctly, Congress was the one that had initially set up those federal jurisdictions anyway. Is that correct?
They did, but you know, I think that these cases are going to end up going up to the Supreme Court, where we will get ultimately rulings that will kind of cabin the reach of some of these temporary restraining orders. And the court is going to have to weigh in. These are really, really big topics that affect national security,
sure,
that affect major questions of federal law. And so, you know, ultimately, I think that what we want is to see the Supreme Court issue strong rulings in favor of the Constitution, and holding these courts accountable to at least what their jurisdiction is, right? Basically, stay in your lane. The courts are so important.
Yeah.
They're our last line of defense.
Sure.
But when they abuse their power, it's just as dangerous as any other federal entity.
Absolutely. That is the perfect way to put that. And unfortunately, we're up against the clock. Kim Herman, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
The Heritage Foundation has been a leading force for decades to develop and promote public policies based on the principles of free enterprise, limited government, individual freedom, traditional American values, and a strong national defense. And I'd like to welcome Hans von Spakovsky to the show. He is the manager of the Heritage Foundation's Election Law Reform Initiative and a senior legal fellow as well. Hans, it is great to talk to you today.
Well, I appreciate you inviting me on.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we wanted to have you on to talk about the implication of Biden using the auto pen and get your thoughts on, as a senior legal fellow, problems also with these judges that are out there throwing themselves in front of the government reform express train as Trump is trying to rein in government and this outrageous spending fraud and abuse. And our good friend Kim Herman, who we just talked to, recommended you as someone who would be good to dig into all of that. And we had asked her off air what she would want to ask you, and what she wanted to know was, what does it look like in the courtrooms right now? Because all of us are reading these transcripts where people will see articles about Trump defying court orders. But what the judge is actually asking in some cases is what they're trying to ask them to provide could be a threat to national security. So her question is, what is actually happening in the courtrooms during those hearings?
Well, some of it is actually pretty bad. And I give an example of that. You know, we had a judge in the District of Columbia, a federal district court judge named Judge Reyes, who just issued a 110-page order telling Pete Hegseth, the Secretary of Defense, and the military that they could not take any actions against transgender individuals in the military. Mm-hmm. If you read her 110-page opinion, I have never seen such vicious, nasty remarks in a order issued by a federal judge. And in fact, the Justice Department filed an ethics complaint against her with the chief judge
Wow.
of the D.C. Circuit, because in the hearing on this case, she made all kinds of insulting, derogatory remarks about the Trump administration, and in particular about the Justice Department lawyer who was arguing the case, even interrogating the Justice Department lawyer about his religious beliefs,
Good
which
gravy.
Is so out of it is so out of line. And in fact, you know, if you look at this order, what does she cite as her supposed law authority for doing what she's doing? She cites Broadway musicals. And unfortunately, that is the kind of thing we're seeing in many of these cases.
That's absolutely stunning.
Isn't it? Yeah, it is.
Oh, absolutely. That kind of vitriol, does that play a role? I mean, because, you know, let's say that gets appealed. That decision, does that kind of vitriol, does that play a role at all in the next higher level court's opinion of that opinion?
Yes, it does, because oftentimes when courts see that, when the appellate courts see that, it's evidence of bias and a lack of impartiality by the district court judge, and that makes them take a very jaundiced look at whatever factual and other legal conclusions that judge puts into the order. So that was a nasty thing for the lawyers arguing the case to happen, but from the standpoint of the Trump administration appealing it, that actually is going to help them in the appeal. Obviously, she just couldn't help herself.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing that we have people like that on benches anywhere, quite frankly. Another question that Kim had for you that she thought people would like to hear the answers to, can the federal government be held in contempt? Because that's really where a lot of this, in her opinion, is headed. And one of the judges is basically threatening jail time for some of the attorneys appearing before him. Is that possible for the judge to do that? Because it shows how extreme they think their own power is.
Yes, they can. If they believe that a lawyer, whether they're a government lawyer or private lawyer, is, for example, not providing information that the court has asked from their client, they can hold lawyers in contempt.
Wow. So
it's unusual. It's rare, but judges do have that power.
You said it's rare. How often does that happen?
It's rare. That's hardly ever happened that I'm aware of.
Wow. So, you know, I think a big question on people's minds is, how do we deal with these resistance judges? You know, people are floating the idea, well, to impeach them, but that is totally ineffective because you need at least 67 votes in the Senate to convict. And I just don't see that ever happening with the current makeup. So what are your thoughts on getting some reform here to these judges?
Well, there's two things here. One is many of these judges are ignoring the rules that the Supreme Court has set out for the granting of injunctions. Those rules are very strict, and it's only under very limited circumstances that an injunction is appropriate. And nationwide injunctions by a single federal district court judge whose jurisdiction is very limited is almost never appropriate. So what needs to happen is the Supreme Court needs to step in on one of these cases, at least, and basically chastise the lower court, which will hopefully get a message to the other courts. I will tell you, Mark, that unfortunately, the Supreme Court actually had an opportunity to do that.
Yes.
2 weeks ago.
Whiffed.
They had a case on an emergency appeal, came up to them. This is the case by the Federal District Court judge in Manhattan, who, by the way, is a dual citizen of the U.S. and Canada, which I didn't realize you could be a dual citizen and be a federal judge. But anyway, he issued an order telling the Trump administration that they had to pay out $2 billion in foreign aid monies that USAID was going to pay out, had been stopped by the Trump administration. In a 5-4 majority, Roberts, unfortunately joined by Amy Coney Barrett, joined the three liberals in saying, well, we're not going to take the case at this point. We're going to wait for it to play out, you know, in the lower courts. There was a stinging, scathing dissent written by Justice Alito, joined by the other three conservative justices, in which he said that he was stunned. That was the word he used, stunned, that the majority did not take up the case to stop a single district court judge thinking that he had the unchecked power to order the government to pay out $2 billion, money they probably wouldn't get back. And he could not believe that the majority didn't take up the case and stop that.
Yeah, yeah. I think that was just a shocking, I agree with Alito. It is absolutely shocking that they did not take that up, because you were effectively giving them carte blanche now to go forward and start overruling everything that Trump tries to do. Okay, it is time for a break. I had wanted to get your thoughts on these activist judges, because it's going to have a huge role in our next topic, and that is the Biden White House staff's use of the auto pen to forge Joe Biden's signatures on legal documents. We'll talk about that next with Hans von Spakovsky from the Heritage Foundation. In our secular world, there's a war between science and faith. And according to the media, science is winning. We all know you can't question science. Or maybe you can. And could that war between faith and science be changing? At the Capital City Republican Women's Luncheon, Thursday, April 10th, from 11:30 to 1, I'll be talking about what you are likely not hearing, that the more real science looks, the more the evidence points to a creator. There's no cost to attend, but if you want to have lunch, that costs $15, and they do need to know that you're coming. Send an email to ccrwsalem, all one word, ccrwsalem@reagan.com. And back now to our show. We are honored to be talking to Hans von Spakovsky, a senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation, where he also manages their election law reform initiative. It was Heritage Foundation's oversight project that exposed someone in the White House was using a device known as the auto pen to sign Joe Biden's signature on various legal documents, including executive orders, pardons, commutations, and others. And I say someone in the White House because obviously it wasn't Joe, because otherwise Joe Biden would have just signed it. Unless, of course, his dementia has gotten so bad that he couldn't remember how to write, and that is certainly a possibility. People with advanced dementia do not remember how to write. And the real question here is, was using that auto pen on legal documents legal? I mean, is just the use of an auto pen enough to cause those documents that were signed with that auto pen to be void and vacant?
The answer to that, I believe, is no. Look, auto pens have been in use, I think, since the Johnson administration, and they are a standard device that's used not just in the White House, but, you know, most members of Congress have them too. The issue is whether or not the president authorized and approved the use of that signature on a specific document. So the example I would give you is, If he had authorized, if he said to his staff, "I'm going to issue a pardon to Hans von Spakovsky," if the staff then uses the auto pen to sign the pardon that he's issued to me, that's valid because the president authorized it. In fact, a lot of people don't realize this, but look, if you look at the Constitution, the pardon provision, there's not even a requirement in writing. If the president got up at a news conference and said, "I hereby issue a pardon to Hans von Spakovsky," it's effective, even if it's not in writing. But if individuals in the White House were using the auto pen to sign documents without the president's specific approval, they are then invalid.
So how does that work? Does that approval have to be granted for each and every auto pen signature, or can he just do a blanket approval that, hey, just use the auto pen whenever you need to? And how is that authorization done? I mean, does he effectively have to sign a document saying it's okay to use the auto pen to create my signature? And if that's the case, then why not just simply sign it?
No, I mean, I don't know, except that he gave so many. Remember, he issued more pardons and commutations than any president in history.
Right.
And, that may be why they use the auto pen on these, but the point is that he would have had to give approval for every single one of these on an individual case-by-case basis. At least that's my opinion. But keep in mind, this is a unique situation. This has never come up as an issue in the entire history of the United States.
Well, that was one of my questions. I mean, is there a precedent of the auto pen being used to sign these official documents? As far as you know?
No.
Okay.
No, not that I'm aware of.
Huh. Well, the fact that they were using the auto pen, first of all, if these are challenged in court, the use of the auto pen, would there be some kind of documentation showing that, yes, he had authorized this? And then how would you know that authorization itself is valid?
Well, that's a matter of evidence to court. But the problem is getting to court, I think, would be extremely difficult. Remember, the federal courts, per the Supreme Court, has a basic rule called standing, right? You cannot bring a claim unless you can show that you personally suffered an injury. Okay, if you can't show that, you can't go to court, no matter what the potential wrong is. So in this case, who is it that would have a potential claim to say I've been personally injured by the use of an auto pen? I don't know who would have standing to sign this, to bring a case like that. The only thing I could think of would be if the Justice Department, the new Justice Department, if they just tried to go and arrest someone who had received a pardon and put them back in prison, that person then would have a claim they could bring in court saying, I was pardoned by the president, and at that point, the Justice Department could try to bring in evidence that he not only didn't cite it, but he didn't authorize it. But I just don't think this Justice Department is going to do that. I don't think they're going to go try to find any of these people who were let out of jail and just grab them and put them in prison. I just don't think it's going to happen.
Well, what about some of these executive orders that he had issued? I mean, if it was affecting, like, say, an entire industry, for example, an executive order was signed for the Keystone Pipeline, that put a lot of people out of work. I mean, wouldn't those people have standing?
Potentially, except for two things. One, remember, one of the first things that President Trump did on January 20th was cancel on void almost every single executive order that had been issued by Joe Biden. So whether they were signed by an auto pen or not, none of them are still in effect. And an individual injured by that can't sue the president or a former president. Why? Well, because presidents are immune from civil litigation and civil claims during for what they did during their time in office.
Well, and isn't that ironic? Because Joe Biden was complaining that that ruling by the Supreme Court that gave the president immunity would lead to a dictatorship. And yet that ruling may, in fact, spare Joe Biden from all of this. All right, it is time for a break. We'll wrap things up. Coming up, we'll be talking about Trump, who has already voided the auto pen signature for that J6 committee. Stay with us. And we're back in our final segment now here on the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today to Hans von Spakovsky, a senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation, and he also manages their election law reform initiative. And so I went out of that break there talking about Trump once learning about this auto pen that was used for such things as blanket pardons for the J6 committee and others. He has voided that. So what are your thoughts on that? I'm assuming that's going to end up in court.
Well, again, the only way I think it would end up in court is if, for example, the Justice Department tried to prosecute members of the J6 investigative committee for some kind of violation of federal law. Unless that happens, it's not going to be in court. And even then, see, I just don't think it's worth pursuing because I have no doubt that if a case like this ended up coming in, you would get testimony, if not directly from Joe Biden, but others in the White House, all saying the same thing, singing from the same choir book that the president specifically authorized this. In fact, I think there's already been an op-ed penned by one of the aides in the White House saying exactly that.
Well, the fact that they were using the auto pen to begin with, I mean, is that effectively, you think, an admission that staff did not think that Joe was mentally competent enough to sign documents? Or if he was mentally competent, does that instead prove that the staff was using the auto pen that Joe was never really in charge? What are your thoughts on why this was used so heavily, other than the fact there was, for example, around the commuting of sentences, there was thousands of those?
I think it's actually more evidence of the mental decay of President Biden. And look, combine this. Like I said, the use of auto pens is normal, but the use of auto pens is for like routine correspondence. You know, it's not used for executive orders or pardons normally. Combine what we've learned about the auto pen with the fact that, remember, Speaker of the House Johnson was interviewed recently, and remember, he said that he had a meeting with Biden at the White House, and he started asking Biden about why he had signed a particular executive order, and the president said, well, I didn't sign that. I don't know what you're talking about. And that, I think, was an indication that his memory was one of the things that had disappeared, and that he couldn't remember signing an executive order on a particular issue.
Yeah, it's definitely troubling. I think it's pretty clear that Joe Biden was never really in charge. I mean, anybody that followed the 2020 campaign knew that Joe was not all there. So I guess it's not surprising. I guess what bothers me so much on a personal level is that It just feels like if they were using the auto pen as heavily as they were, I mean, you could literally have anybody walk in to the Oval Office or wherever it is they keep that pen with a legal document and walk out with the president's signature on it. And unless there's that paper trail, I mean, who knows what they were enacting?
Oh, look, you're absolutely right. And that's one of the problems with the fact that it appears that Biden was not mentally had diminished mental capacity for some period of time before, was that it meant his staff had control of the executive office of the White House. And that is not a situation that is supposed to arise.
No, absolutely not. So we only got a couple minutes here with you. And I was doing some background research on you, and I'd love to get your take on this, but it turns out that you're rather hated by the left for your work on election integrity. There's an article in The Guardian about you from July of last year titled, "The Man Who Cries Voter Fraud, How Hans von Spakovsky Has Built a Career Peddling Election Fraud, Election Security Fears," which is kind of a weird take when you think about it. Shouldn't we all want election security? But you know, as it happens, we spent the last couple of weeks looking at voter fraud, and just last week we spoke with Jerome Corsi about a case in Florida, on Congressional District 14, that has uncovered evidence of cloned voters. And these are duplicates of existing real voters with slight modifications inserted there by very sophisticated algorithms. In your work on election integrity, have you also seen evidence of cloned voters?
We've seen evidence of all kinds of fraud, including that. Look, one of the things we do at the Heritage Foundation, and this is what really upsets the left, is remember, they used to claim election fraud never happens.
Right.
Well, they can't do that anymore because a number of years ago, we started an election fraud database at the Heritage Foundation. It's the only one in the country. It's unique. It's up on our website. People can pull it up. They can see proven cases of fraud from every state in the nation. Mark, we're certainly going to hit 1,600.
Oh my gosh.
Proven cases of fraud. 1,600. And I can't tell you how many reporters that I've dealt with who they're really angry that we have this database because it messes up their story.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. When you want to spin this notion that there's never any election fraud, never any voter fraud, I mean, 1,600 cases, my goodness, that certainly nails that coffin shut. Unfortunately, we are up against the clock. I want to thank you so much for your time today. This has been great.
Well, thanks for having me.
It would not surprise me one bit that Trump will want to push things on this whole auto pen business, so this may end up in court yet. Plus, that could be a really good way to find out who was actually in charge this whole time. What fun and interesting times we live in. Especially so, as we said in the beginning, that endangerment finding may finally be over, and that will rob an awful lot of free money that the left has been thriving on all of this time. Imagine an ideology so weak and so valueless that in order to keep it going, you have to prop it up by stealing billions of dollars from taxpayers. But we all know that if that endangerment finding does end, it won't be the end of things, which is why you need to always be watching, and it's not just the Democrats. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.